again, and welcome to Musings on Golf, where the story in our game played out on Sunday in the California desert as Nick Dunlap became the first amateur to win a PGA Tour event since a young fellow named Phil Mickelson did so in 1991. My name is Kelly Elbin, and in addition to my co-host, Robert Bupka, you'll be hearing later from Ian Woosnam, who captured his Masters title in 1991 as well. But Bob, how about that tall 20-year-old sophomore at the University of Alabama who took down a very strong professional field at the American Express?
Well, well said, Kelly. And you know, I loved his composure coming down the stretch. He didn't seem to rush. He didn't seem to take too much time. He just went about his business almost like he knew he had the talent to win. It was just a matter of putting it on display, and on display he did, and so happy for him. His mother and father had flown in the night before, so they got to watch it. Just an incredible feat in the world of golf. Anytime something only happens back in 1991, and we're in 2024, I mean, that's pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah, and the ebbs and flows of his final round. So he goes in with a three-shot lead. He loses that. He gains it back. And then down the stretch, whereas a seasoned veteran as Sam Burns hits some balls in the water, this kid really goes head-to-head with Christian Bezuidenhout and has to make two clutch pars, 17 and then about a six-footer on 18. Strong field again. Not only does he hold off those guys, Xander Schauffele, Justin Thomas, Scotty Scheffler, all in this field, finishes at 29 under, the lowest score since the tournament went from 90 holes to 72. You talk about earning your stripes, Bob.
Yeah, and you know what? After I read this stat for our listeners, they'll have to agree with us that certainly no surprise. The only player, Kelly Elbin, other than Tiger, to win both the U.S. Junior and the U.S. Amateur. Boy, oh boy, that's impressive credentials.
So he forfeited the $1.5 million first place prize. He has since withdrawn from the Farmers Insurance Open, where he was in the field on a sponsor's exemption. Bob, I think he just needs a breather. I mean, there's a lot to think about for a 20-year-old. He grew up an Alabama fan. He desperately wants to win an NCAA title at Alabama. If he stays on tour, he gets into the Masters. He could turn professional, yes, and accept an offer from the PGA Tour to do so. My sense is, just a gut feeling, is he's going to stay in school and sort of reap the rewards, if you will, and then look to turn professional after this year.
I mean, there's no doubt the maturity of this individual. There's pros and cons whether he should turn pro, and golf's that crazy sport where you one swing away from an injury, and many of our listeners probably be on the side of the fence that say, why not turn pro, get your money, you never know. But he seems to have an awful level head on his shoulders, so his game plan has been excellent so far. Yeah. I think we'll just stick with whatever Mr. Dunlap decides is best for him.
Right, and that is whatever's going to happen. But as to what he accomplished, as you hear in this, I mean, first of all, his thoughts on winning a PGA Tour event, and then, you know, frankly, did he think he could hold it together down the stretch?
It's definitely got a good ring to it. I will say that, but it's, you know, everything that I dreamed of, and just to have a chance in the last hole to win a PGA Tour event is really special. Everybody's got doubts. You know, I probably had 1,000 different scenarios in my head of how today was going to go, and it went nothing like I expected. And I think that was the cool part about it. That's golf, and you know, I hit a lot of shots that I didn't think I was going to hit, and then, you know, I hit some shots that went way better than I expected. And you know, the same thing with putting. And like I said, I just think that's the cool part of golf.
Bob, when you hear his voice, that level head, man, at age 20, it's so important, isn't it, to sort of keep that flat line, particularly in the ultimate heat of the moment, and not get, you know, bigger picture of where he is, that he's got shots to execute, and that's exactly what he did.
Well said, Kelly, because if you're looking to build a prototype of a professional golfer, you're going to start really with what they got going upstairs, and then later on, they can work on their physical ability to play the game. Because if you don't have it upstairs, I don't care how long you practice, how talented you are, you have to be mentally tough to get the job done. And good golly, did Mr. Dunlap show us a perfect example of being tough down the stretch.
And also in this world of name, image, and likeness, the NIL deal that so many college athletes are taking advantage of. He's already signed a contract with Adidas. Did so before the U.S. Amateur. So he's profiting, if not from winning at the American Express, he's profiting based on deals off the field. Interestingly enough, he also shares the same agent as Bryson DeChambeau, Sergio Garcia, and others who went to something called Live Golf. So there's already been some questions out there about whether he may make that jump. But again, I get the sense there's a lot of tradition with him. And I would be very surprised if he were to jump to Live. But again, I'd been very surprised with a lot of guys who've jumped to Live Golf. You never know, Bob.
You never know. And certainly taking the same agent as Bryson, Sergio, and others that went to Live cannot, and I stress this, cannot make Jay Monahan too comfortable.
One other thing before we get to Rory winning for the fourth time in Dubai. There was a bettor in Iowa who put down $300 on Dunlap, 500-1 odds, and he walked away with a little more than $150,000. How's that, Robert?
Give me his phone number. I see if I can borrow 10 bucks.
Right?
That's pretty good.
Rory McIlroy, DP World Tour. Rory McIlroy wins for the fourth time at the Dubai Desert Classic. His parents were there. Lovely picture of them celebrating the victory. Let's hear what it meant for Rory, how big this win was, number four for him at that event.
It's big. Getting a win early in the year is always important. I think it really it can sort of act as a nice springboard into the rest of the year. So I knew my game was in good shape. I think getting the wins just sort of validates that you're on the right path and you're doing the right thing. So, I feel good about everything I've done over the past couple of weeks, and it's been a great start to the year, and I want to kick on from here and, keep playing the way I'm playing. I still feel like there's a few things I need to improve, but every week that I play, I learn a little bit more, and, hopefully I'll take the learnings from this week into the next few weeks and, building up to the major season.
A heck of a springboard, Bob. Second the week before to Tommy Fleetwood. He wins the week after. Is this the year, Bob? Is this is everything pointing in the right direction for Rory for those four special days at Augusta National?
Well, you certainly would think so based on his talent, based on his performance. I think if he goes in there confident with his putter, and that's the only thing that scares me a little bit, about Rory. I'd long ago, and I interviewed him when he was 16 and playing in the Open Championship at Carnoustie. I knew I was dealing with somebody that was way, way above average as far as talent goes. But, the putter is it's just a fickle stick in that bag. And if he gets it rolling early, when we get to April and the Masters, certainly nobody more deserving of slipping on a green jacket other than Rory McIlroy.
Well, that's right. In a little bit, we're going to hear from 1991 Masters champion Ian Woosnam. But right now, we're going to pay a tribute to a gentleman who passed away. And you talk about a rich life in golf, Jack Burke Jr. passing away last week, 10 days short of what would have been his 101st birthday. He was the oldest living member of the World Golf Hall of Fame. Won the 56 Masters, coming from 8 shots back at a time when it looked like Ken Venturi had that. And then later that year won the PGA Championship in match play. Bob, you're a Houston guy right now. You have been for a while. He and Jimmy Demeritt built the Champions Club there. What a life that he led, and what a passion he had for the game of golf.
And you know, the amazing thing, after I heard of his passing, I was thinking back to the precious times that I got to spend with Mr. Burke, and it almost made you feel like I was getting a sampling of heaven being around him. He was just such a gentleman, such a talent, and a great sense of humor, by the way. I remember standing alongside of him out at Champions, and who walks by? None other than Doug Sanders. And Jackie taps me on the shoulder, and he says, "Hey, Bob, you know what Doug Sanders does with his old clothes?" I said, "No, I don't, Jackie." He says, "He wears them." And that was Jackie Burke. He, down to earth, good guy. Boy, oh boy, if golf, it has a lot of Jackie Burks, but if it had all Jackie Burks, it'd be the greatest sport that's ever been played.
He was the son of a golf professional. He went on to be an assistant professional to the legendary Claude Harmon at Winged Foot, was a club professional himself at Metropolis in the greater New York area. And then he went on tour, and he won a few times, and then 56 came along, and it all came together for him. Went on to captain the Ryder Cup team, as I mentioned, the World Golf Hall of Fame. But Champions Club, by the way, Bob, you've been there, as you were mentioning. He and Demeritt built that for good players. They didn't build that to have a great clubhouse and a great, you know, food and this and that. He built it as a really stern test for outstanding players.
Absolutely, and Ben Hogan used to play there on a regular basis because he said it really sharpened his game to play Champions. So once again, the world of golf is going to miss Jackie Burke. We don't get many that come along with the caliber and respect earned of Jackie Burke. So condolences to his lovely wife Robin, who's a heck of a golfer in her own right. I remember some City of Houston championships between Robin and our executive producer, Janice Self. So when I say that Robin was a very talented golfer, I'm getting the message across that Janice certainly was in that league. Good buddies, but good golfers, both of them, to say the least.
Yeah, and we'll turn our attention real quickly to Ian Woosnam. I know people want to hear from Woozy. Fascinating story, Bob. And certainly not the biggest golfer by any means in terms of height, but great strength, great resolve, good putting touch when he needed to, won a number of times over in Europe. The 91 Masters, of course, was the biggest moment in his life. And I enjoyed talking to Woozy. He's got a good way about him. And someone who also cares very deeply about the game.
Yeah, absolutely. A wonderful ambassador. And if one of your resolutions for this upcoming golf season, you say to yourself, "I want to look the best. I want to feel the best when I'm out there in that golf course," well, turn to the luxury lifestyle of William and Harry. Those golf shoes, they feel like velvet on your feet. You'll be very comfortable, you'll play better, and most important, you're certainly going to look better. Remember that name. It's catching on fast. Be the first in your club to get a pair, William and Harry.
Absolutely, and you're going to hear from them, and then you're going to hear from Woozy coming up right now. William and Harry has launched a line of stylish waterproof golf shoes, and they are incredibly comfortable. The WH golf shoe is made of deerskin and suede. It has a gel insert, a form-fitting inner lining, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes on the outside of each shoe provide maximum performance. It's time to elevate your game. It's time to go to williamandharry.com.
When you reach for a T-Series iron, you are pulling more than a piece of equipment. You are choosing a club built with a deep understanding of the game. Working with tour pros and dedicated amateurs, the Titleist team attacks every facet of every T-Series iron. So whether you want effortless speed, exceptional feel, or precise control, T-Series offers everything you need to construct your ideal iron setup. Go to Titleist.com to explore a complete lineup and find a fitter near you. New T-Series irons from Titleist.
Welcome back to Musings on Golf. Bob, the wee Welshman, has stood tall in the game of golf since he engineered four magical rounds and slipped on the green jacket in 1991. He was the number one ranked player in the world for 50 straight weeks, and he put an exclamation point on an outstanding Ryder Cup career by captaining the winning European side in 2006 in Ireland. What a treat to be joined by Ian Woosnam. Hey, Woozy, how are things in Barbados?
Oh, it's pretty cool down here. Beautiful. Breeze is blowing, the sun is shining, and what else could you ask for?
Hi, Woozy. Bob Bupka. I guess you know me from Talk Sport. Yeah. You know, you're the only Welshman to win a major championship. I mean, how did a kid from Wales become such an elite golfer?
Oh, you know, Bob, it's quite an interesting story, really. You know, I live right on the border. I was born in England, but my parents are Welsh, so I decided to represent Wales because at that time I wasn't the greatest golfer in the world when I was younger. I was up and down a little bit, and if I wanted to get in the international teams, I decided to play for Wales, and that's what I did. But I had a really good buddy, which lived a few miles away from me, who was my partner in the teams, which was when in them days I used to play in the English teams as a school kid, in our Shropshire's teams, I should say, and his name was Sandy Lyle. And he was a pretty impressive guy from 13 years of age. And I knew that I had to, if I needed to be any good in the game, I needed to be as good as him.
Wow, what an interesting story. Sandy, certainly one of the true giants of the game, just like yourself. And let me ask you this, Woozy. What was it like in the early years before you became known? What was life like in that blue Volkswagen camper and just surviving on beans and bacon?
Well, that was an experience, but it's a great experience. What any young man should have really in their lives is that, you know, in them days of the European tour traveled to Sorolla, let's say it would go to Portugal, then it would go to Spain, then it would go to Italy, and then it would go to France, and then it would come back to the UK. So you could drive down to them countries and go from week to week to week and eventually end up at home. So, you know, traveling down in my little van, it meant that, you know, I could live cheaply. I could live at the golf course, use their facilities, park on the practice ground, and practice. And as they all say, as Gary Player says, practice makes perfect. And that's what I did when I was a youngster.
How long did you travel like that?
Basically from about 1978 to 82. And I started making some money, and things changed then. And then basically I could afford to go on airplanes and stay in different places. Basically, that was it.
Ian, I've covered many Ryder Cups, and I'm dying to ask you this question. Why does the Ryder Cup mean so much more to the Europeans, to the European side, than it does to the American side? I've said for years, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I said the Americans were interested in making the Ryder Cup team, where I got the impression, distinct impression, from the European side, they were interested in winning the Ryder Cup. They were not satisfied just to be on the Ryder Cup team. Am I accurate?
Well, you could, in a sort of way, but I think, you know, it means such a lot for a European player to be on that Ryder Cup. I think the Americans had won it so many times that they'd lost a slight bit of interest in it. And all of a sudden, we changed to sort of not just Great Britain and Ireland, we changed to Europe, and then that changed the dynamics of it a little bit. And then, but I think what it was more about, I would say, Bob, is that, you know, getting into American tournaments, getting into majors, that the European players felt like they were hard done by, because it was so hard to get in these tournaments. And I think it was one way that the European players could play in the Ryder Cup and show that we are as good as America and better in some ways as well. So I think that was, for a young player, or like for myself, is to show that the rest of the world, you know, it's not all about the American tour. There is a European tour out there as well, just as good.
Woozy, during those years, you really didn't have all that much crossover in terms of going and playing, guys on the European side going and playing on the American tour, did you? Certainly nothing like you have today.
No, exactly. It's all a bit of a different system now and everything. Some of it I don't agree with now whatsoever. I feel that, you know, I'm going to say this now, I just don't feel that the DP Tour has gone the right way for what we should have done with the second biggest tour in the world. And God knows where we are now. That's just my opinion. And so I think we've been sold down the river a little bit. And, okay, we do get 10 spots. But we're losing our 10 best players every year to go to the American Tour. So I'm not sure what's happening with all this stuff going on, but I'm not liking it anyway. But as you say, we didn't get that many spots to play in America, and when we did, we tried to take a full advantage of it.
Well, we're delighted to be joined by Ian Woosnam, World Golf Hall of Fame member, here on Musings on Golf. And Woozy, at the outset, I mentioned that you were talking to us from Barbados. Tell Bob and me and our listeners about Apes Hill, Barbados, where you play out of.
Yeah, Apes Hill it's been around for quite a few many years. You know, it was taken over and we redesigned, and it's a wonderful spot. It's at the northern side of, middle side, northern side of Barbados. It's up on the hill and it's an incredible view. It's when you get onto the sort of the 12th tee, you can see, and 13th and 14th, you can see the Atlantic Ocean, and you can see the Caribbean Ocean, and it's an incredible golf course to come and play and stay and have a wonderful time. And you know, I'm very proud to be an ambassador for Apes Hill at the moment.
How long have you been involved with them?
Only recently, in the last 6 months or so. But you know, I've been associated playing that golf course for the last 15 or 16 years. I was friends with, and still friends with, the past owners. Now it's been taken over. It's been redesigned and by Ron Kirby, and it's a beautiful little golf course, and they made it a little bit more easier and a bit more friendlier. The green's a little softer, so it is quite windy as well, and it's a little bit cooler up the top of the island. So it's a good day out.
Woozy, I know you're a big fan of the history of the game, with the likes of Ben Hogan and Byron Nelson having been born so close to one another and becoming the dominant players of their era. You were part of a group of five: Seve, Sir Nick, Bernhard Langer, and your buddy Sandy Lyle, all being born within 12 months of one another. Did you guys, as you started to become bigger players on the world stage, did you have any sense of your role of really changing the fortunes of European golf, and frankly, making the game even more global than it was before?
Yes, I guess so. We've always had some marvelous players in Europe. Unfortunately, I was going on before that, they didn't have the chance to sort of get into many tournaments in America. But as the force of us five started to play really well, Seve, he was the start of it, and Faldo, Langer, and Lyle and myself came along, and that made the, as you say, that we started getting in the majors and started winning them majors, and that, as I said, it grew the name of the European Tour, and as you said, globally as well. We played globally as well.
Yeah, I'm wondering, separate from Ryder Cup weeks, did you play a lot of golf? Did you play practice rounds during your years on the European Tour with Sandy, with Faldo?
Yeah.
How did that work?
I play quite a lot of it with Sandy, but the other guys, they were very individual. Sebi would play with his Spanish guys, and Faldo was kept himself to himself, and Bernard was, you know, just a brilliant guy, but he was just he's not stuck in his ways, but he was more methodical. He would play with his German friends, or he'd have his friends as well. But in Europe, we tend to stick to our friends and play with our friends and stay in little groups, and that's what Europe was all about. And you know, it's a little bit different in America. When you came to America, you go out for dinner and you don't see anybody. You know, it's so big and vast. And you know, when we were in Europe, we stay in all in the same hotels. We go to the same restaurants. We were all there together, really, one big family.
Yeah, let me ask you this. What do you think the secret is to Bernhard Langer? I mean, he plays like he's 20 years younger than he is.
He most probably is. he just manages his life so stupidly. You know, he does exactly the same things, and he doesn't get too far in front of him. He's very methodical. I'll tell you a little story. When I play with him in the Ryder Cup, and we're playing every other shot, and foursomes, as we call it, and he says, "Roosie, like when we're on a par five and we have to lay up, can you sort of leave it sort of 80 yards for the green for my 60 degree wedge, or can you leave it like 103 yards for my 52 degree?" I said, "Bernard, I will try my best. If I can do that, I will do it for you." And he turns around to me and says, "Ian, you know, what distance would you like?" I said, "Bernard, I don't know. Just hit it down the fairway. I'll sort it out when I get there." Complete different characters. You know, I'm very natural. He's very methodical, and all those like that as well. Sevi was very natural. Sandy was very natural. And in a way, five different characters are playing golf.
And what do you mean by natural? What is that? As I understand the methodical approach to Langer, but what does the term for you natural mean?
Well, it's just two turns and a swish, isn't it? You know, and the ball just gets in the way. And, you know, I look at the distance when I'm going up the fairway. I know it's, you know, I look at it from 50 yards away. I know that's either going to be a 6-iron or a 5-iron. I don't have to think about it too much. Just when I get there and decide which shot I want to hit. That's a different way I look at and approach the game.
Yeah.
Let me take you back to the year 1991 at Augusta. You had just become the number one player in the world the Monday before the Masters. What was that like, and what was it like winning the Masters?
Well, unbelievable. You know, to become number one in the world on the Monday morning and finishing the week being a Masters champion is all like one dream coming true in 1 week, isn't it? And, you know, incredible. I think becoming world number one sort of like gave me that extra little boost that week. And I could just go out, puff my chest out a little bit, saying, "I'm actually the best player in. I'm the best player here. Come and get me and try and beat me." I'd won a couple of weeks before in New Orleans, so I was pretty confident at the time.
You certainly had a lot of game, I'll tell you that much. Every time I saw you play, I was really impressed. You talked earlier about the Ryder Cup. You played on winning teams and captained the winning side in 06 in Ireland. What did that mean to you to be European Ryder Cup captain?
Well, you know, you want to be in the teams. Being Ryder Cup teams, and then having the privilege to be nominated to be the captain, and to be in Ireland, where I've had quite a lot of success and quite popular in Ireland. And I thought, this is going to. I hadn't been there. I don't think I'd been in Ireland before, so it was going to be huge, and it was going to be a fantastic atmosphere. And all I wanted to do was obviously try to win. Being the captain and just try and have the respect of my players, and that's what it was all about. Fortunately, we had a fantastic week. You know, we managed to win by quite a bit, but it was an unbelievable experience to be in charge of 12 wonderful guys. You know, you feel like you're showing your age when you get to that, though. But you know, I took my captaincy from the captains I had had before, like Tony Jackson, Bernard Gallagher, Sam Torrance, and I learned a lot, and that made the job a lot more easier as well.
Ian, I have to ask you this, and I know it's probably a touchy subject, but at the 01 Open Championship at Royal Lytham and St. Anne's, you're leading in the final round. You nearly make a hole in one on that first hole. We're going crazy in the TalkSport radio booth. And then all of a sudden, we see quite a commotion taking place down on the second tee. We didn't know what it was about, but apparently you found a 15th club in your bag. Tell us about that.
Well, that week I was only using the driver about four times, and I wasn't driving the ball very well. So I decided to try another driver on the practice ground with a metal shaft in it to see if that would straighten me out a little bit. But that wasn't the answer, and we're walking away back from the practice ground, and I said to my caddy, just make sure you take that back into the locker room. But as we went a few more yards, we started doing some chipping with Peter Cowan, with my coach at the time, and we got involved doing that a little bit, went to the practice, then to the putting green. And as you know, Lytham starts with a par three, so we get on the tee and obviously whatever it was, a fix iron, hit it to a few inches, and started with a birdie to join the leader or go in the lead for the tournament. And then walk into the next tee, he said, you're going to go ballistic. He passes me driver, and I said, what's the matter? He said, we got two drivers in the bag. And yeah, you can imagine there was a few choice words. And it was a disappointment. And things happen, don't they, in life? And that's how, the trouble is, it's like, it's amazing how many people remember that, that situation.
Yeah, Ian, I'm not sure, but I think maybe that very popular slogan in golf originated from that. Quite often you'll hear one player tell another player, you had too much club.
Well, maybe that's the question that usually I get when I'm playing in a tournament, and it's how many clubs you got in your bag. I said, do you like being at the tournament? I said, I can get rid of you quite easily.
What happened to the caddy that day?
I didn't sack him. I kept him for I kept him, and then unfortunately he decided to say enough was enough after a couple of weeks. He just didn't turn up and disappeared. I haven't pretty well seen him since. So
wow.
I don't know where he is. He's back in Ireland, so he doesn't caddy anymore.
New definition of getting rid of a caddy.
Yeah, I think a lot of guys were giving him some jip, and some stick, and I think he just decided to walk away from it, from caddying.
The great Ian Woosnam joining us here on Musings on Golf. Hey, Woozy, a couple of questions about the Masters. What is it like for you to keep going back every year and be part of that Tuesday night Champions Dinner? It has to be among your highlights each year.
Yeah, it's fantastic, I don't play. I've stopped playing now to actually go. I do have an hour round on the Sunday, and then we have the dinner on the Tuesday. It's to see the past champions and the new champion coming and picking up his medal at the dinner. And some of the stories and the different foods and the different wines we have. It's an incredible experience for past champion or for a new champion.
Follow up a question. We talked about your victory in 91. You had been close. You were tied for third at the 86 Open Championship, tied for second at the 89 U.S. Open. What's the difference for you down the stretch in 91 to hold off Jose Maria by a shot and win your major championship? What set you apart that week?
I think it's just that, just experience. I think I'd won a couple of weeks before in America. I think that gave me the confidence as well. And I think Augusta was a golf course that really suited me as well. I was having an incredible year. I was hitting the ball miles. My irons were good. But one of the main things is that I found a putter. After the first round, I was using a ping. And I shot level par, and I didn't particularly putt very well. And I decided to change the putter to a tad more. I met one of Sandy's friends, and his name was Tad Moore. And he had this putter, and I practiced for 3 hours with it on a Thursday evening, and I decided to take it out the next morning where I was really confident from 3 foot. And I think if you're confident from 3 foot in at Augusta, you've got a big chance. So that means you can go for your putts a little bit, and it just changed my confidence. And that, I think that was the winning club in my bag that week.
Was that a rarity for you to change a major part of your equipment midstream after a round in a major championship? Had you done that before?
Oh, I do it all the time. Playing the clubs, playing the tools. As I say, I wish I hadn't let them. I'd have been fine.
You know, Ian, it's funny you tell that story about the Tad Moore. That January, prior to that Masters, I was at the PGA Merchandise Show in Orlando, Florida, and there was a gentleman there with his putter on exhibit, and it was Tad Moore. And he asked me to come over and take a look at it, and I was fascinated how well the ball came off the club face. It just seemed to make it roll so much better, and I'm finding out now that's the putter that you switched to. What a small world.
Absolutely, and it was incredible. It made a sort of a little ping noise, just a thin little blade I had, and it was, I've still got it, and I still fancy putting with it, but, the big mallet, big head, it feels a bit better at the moment. You've got the shakes a little bit.
Well, speaking of big, Ian, you have been a big-time guest on our show, Musings on Golf. What a pleasure. What an honor. I've known for quite a while you were very special on the golf course, but you also was very special off the golf course and one of the great ambassadors for the sport of golf. And I'll let Kelly wrap it up. But from myself, Ian, pleasure to talk to you. Stay in good health, my friend, and keep using that Tad Moore.
I will. Thanks, Bob. Speak to you soon, Paul.
Hey, Woozy, in closing, I hope that our listeners learn more about Apes Hill in Barbados. And we've asked a number of our recent guests if they had a dream foursome, three players to round out a round of golf, one special round, whether those individuals are deceased or still with us. Who would be the three who would round out your foursome?
Oh, I'd must probably go Ben Hogan, Bobby Jones, and Jack Nicklaus. But that would have been brilliant golfing.
Ian Woosnam, thank you again. All the best, and we'll talk to you soon. Just like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry. I love these golf shoes. They're made of deerskin and suede with a soft gel insert. And the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance. And they are so incredibly comfortable. I invite you to head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best and play your best with William & Harry. I was fascinated, Bob, by Ian's story about traveling around in that VW camper and eating beans and bacon and living out of the parking lots at the courses where they play. We all have to have a beginning somewhere, right? And while his was modest, man, the ending and everything that's come from it, he's earned every cent, every accolade, every reward.
Yeah, he certainly has. A real gentleman, a real class act, somebody that I've been friends with for quite a while, mainly due to my association with Talk Sport, covering golf for them for the last 20 years. I really became close to Woozy, and just a fine gentleman. You got a good feeling when you put your hand out and shake the hand of Ian Woosnam. You knew you were shaking the hand of a great gentleman.
We thank Woozy for his time. And next week, really looking forward to talking with Doug Ferguson, the longtime lead golf writer for the Associated Press. And no one from the print world is closer to the world of golf than Doug Ferguson, who's been out there for many, many years. Bob, you've known Doug. Terrific writer, knows the game inside and out.
Yes, he does. And I know this much. He's probably the hardest worker out there because 99% of the time when I showed up in the interview room, Doug was in there already working. 99% of the time when I left the interview room at night, Doug was in there working. Just has a tremendous passion for what he does, takes a lot of pride in his writing, and it's certainly reflected in the manner in which he covers the world of professional golf. Looking forward to chatting with Doug Ferguson next week.
Absolutely. We hope all of you enjoyed this version. And for my good friend Bob Bubka, Kelly Elbin signing off for Musings on Golf.